Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, have you heard of the concept of the universal basic income, or the idea of basic income? It's not the basic wage. That's a thing we're used to. The idea that if you work, then you shouldn't get paid less than a certain government mandated amount to try and prevent people from being exploited in the workforce. That's a different idea. This is the idea that in the future, you might get a regular or one-off payment from the government, not because you work or indeed do anything in particular, just because you're a citizen. Now, it's not as stupid as it sounds, and there are powerful reasons why this might be necessary. It already happens in Alaska. Citizens in Alaska get $2,000 a year. No questions asked. In fact, even children in Alaska get the money. What's the point of it, and could it ever work in Australia? The idea, of course, is that with the advance of the robots and the increasing automation of much of our work, that there just will not be enough work to go around, despite the fact that society itself, the economy itself, is wealthy and producing a great deal. Where is that money to go? Into the hands of those who have capital, or should it go perhaps to everyone? This is the idea of it. It's an idea that's challenging the notion of welfare as we know it. This is the idea that the government would help you out while you get a job, which is, after all, the preferred state. What if the government basically said, well, we understand the economy can't actually provide enough jobs for everyone. We'll just give you a slice of the pie, no questions asked, and you can do what you want. If you want to work, you can. You get more, but at least you get this basic amount. Tonight, we're exploring this idea with a couple of economics experts. One is Dr. Gigi Foster, an economist at the University of New South Wales, and she's in the studio with us this evening. Gigi, good evening to you.
Thank you.
Good to have you in.
Thank you.
And the other is Dr. Ben Spies-Butcher, a senior lecturer in economy and society in the sociology department at Macquarie University, who's been writing on the subject too, and he's in the studio with us too. Hi, Ben.
Hey.
All right. Well, let's start with some fundamentals. How does a basic income work, Gigi?
Well, basically, the way it's usually spoken of is that you give a certain amount every year to every adult citizen of a country. And they've trialed this in both developing countries and developed countries. Right now in Finland, I believe, they're doing a trial, which is only for a limited number of people, so 10,000 people. And it's costing about $40 million Australian, I think, to run this. And they're going to look over 2 years to see what the effects are and, you know, evaluate the program. In Australia, the figure that I've heard bandied about is somewhere between $10,000 and $25,000 per year. Per person. And this would be universal. I mean, that's what the title says. It's what it means. It's given to everybody. And it would basically, as an economist, my main concern about it is it's just very, very expensive. So you have to find the money to fund the thing. At the moment, our welfare system, which includes, you know, the age pension and the child care payments and you know, various other disability support schemes and whatnot, comes to about $160 to $190 billion a year. So that's about maybe roughly 10% of Australian GDP. If you give $20,000 to every man and woman in Australia every year, you're talking about more than twice that cost. And so if you're going to really seriously consider it, you'd have to think about how you're going to raise the money.
Of course, although, and we'll get there, I hope, in this hour too, advocates of the system say, well, yes, but it would involve rejigging some of this, and not necessarily adding to the current welfare bill, but rejigging the current welfare bill, including the current tax bill, and notions such as the tax-free threshold, for example. Ben, how do you see it working?
Yeah, well, I think the thing that's closest to it that we have at the moment is the age pension, which does have a set amount, which we say is enough to live on. Might have some debates about that, but and it we don't really ask many questions about it. So there's no work test, there's no character test, and it's the only difference is that, you know, there's a means test. Now the means test is actually not a million miles away from just having slightly higher tax rates to be able to fund it. So we could imagine, in fact, New Zealand does have an age pension system that doesn't have a means test. So I think if we were going down this route, we'd probably look at trying to expand the age pension or something very similar to it to the whole adult population.
Because the truth of it is, isn't it, and that in most Western countries, although governments go on about jobs and growth, of course, the well-known economist here in Australia, who hasn't been that successful in recent months at least, but that despite the fact that politicians go on about it, the number of full-time jobs that the economies are creating is not keeping up with the demand, because the number of casualised jobs or part-time opportunities are out there, but full-time jobs are becoming rarer and rarer, and based on current trends, aren't likely to be able to fulfil demand, are they?
No, this has definitely been a trend since the really late 1980s. The technological revolution, skill bias, technological change is what we call it. You know, a lot of automation, and people struggle to get full-time positions. That's certainly true in universities as well as other sectors. And so one of the responses has been, oh, we need to provide more job security somehow, or some kind of financial security to those people who are really struggling to get full-time work. And I think one of the issues, and this is similar to what Ben was saying, one of the things we face is perhaps some antiquated rules around job-seeking behavior that's mandated under the New Start allowance, for example, where, you know, the sorts of requirements that somebody has to jump through may not really be keeping pace with the modern economy. And so we could take the systems we have at the moment and make some edits to try to accommodate those additional changes, to try to be more flexible in the way that we provide that kind of unemployment insurance or underemployment insurance.
It's never been, I mean, it is being, I think, trialed in Finland, as you say. It's there are elements of it in Alaska. There are certainly elements of it in the Middle East. But then again, they've got a lot of cash to splash around on a relatively small population. It is being trialled, I understand, in Central Africa too.
Yes, with some evaluations as well, which look reasonably promising. But that's a very different situation, right? Developing countries and developed countries are very different.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. But and one of the big, I suppose, unanswered questions is that would it change human behaviour? After all, we're being told that a basic of human behaviour is the desire is hunger. That is in a spiritual as well as physical sense. That if you want to get on, you've got to have something to get you out of bed in the morning and get you going. And work is it, because after all, work's the path. Work or study or application of some kind is the path to prosperity. In a sense, does this universal basic income idea challenge this a bit? Does it,
Ben? Look, yeah, I think it does. But there's no really good evidence that this is going to stop people working. I think it's partly about rethinking the what it is to work and why people work. So there were also some trials a bit earlier in Canada and in the US. And where they trialled it there for reasonable periods of time, actually it didn't have this strong disincentive to work. The two groups of people that worked a little bit less were young men who decided to spend more time at school and women who just had children who decided to spend more time with their kids. And other than that, actually, people continued to work. And it turns out people work for all sorts of reasons and will, I think, continue to work even if they have a very basic income provided for them by the government.
Yeah, this is the surprising thing, isn't it, that the studies we have at the moment, they're not huge, but the studies we have at the moment do suggest that even if you pay people to stay at home, in a sense, they're still keen to get out there and do things. Well, and it might not be indulging in paid work, but it could be study, for example, or it could be acquisition of skills. It could be trying to set up a business, for example. It could be some other thing.
Yeah, look, I think there are two things to say about that. The first is that it's been found in many other studies that work is good for you. There are studies of sort of the psychological effects of retirement, for example, and of job loss in midlife. And they are almost uniformly negative in some way. And the fact is that we are social animals and we get a lot of socialization at work. We form our identities about who we are and what we mean. And also everybody wants to be a winner. And in this society, and it's not going to go away anytime soon, having a job and having a good income is part of being a winner in most people's minds. And so I don't think that motivation is going to be, you know, that easy to quash. Now, at the same time, if you're going to be raising the kind of money you need to fund a UBI scheme, you're going to have to either raise marginal tax rates or do away with the tax-free threshold or both. And that might be a dampener on, the intensive margin of work. So people may find like there's going to be kinks that crop up and that people may, you know, bring their working hours down. But the other thing to say about this is really we have to think about what the poor actually need. There's an element here of either give them a fish or teach them to fish. And I think to a certain extent, handing out checks, it feels like an easy solution and a good solution, sort of a feel-good solution, but it's very simplistic. And oftentimes the real needs of the poor or the underemployed and the struggling in our society are not really just to do with money. Sometimes it is to do with money, but not just that. It's also access. It's also skills. And so coupling that sort of support, really good support in relation to access to markets and skill development development with money, I think is a better way to go.
Goran makes a good point on the text line. Thanks, Goran. 0467922702 is the text line. Goran says, you talk about production going swimmingly, but of course there has to be somebody on the other side to buy the products. No point if people can't afford to buy the products. And in essence, that is true, isn't it? I mean, in a sense, although it may sound a bit wacky, it's actually part of economics laws of supply and demand that if you give people a universal basic income, you're giving them income which they will spend because they're not going to do anything else with it.
I mean, they can't save it, I suppose, but yeah, it's like a huge, long-lasting Keynesian stimulus.
And it's also true that people on lower incomes tend to spend more of their money. So this is actually quite a good way of probably being able to create jobs.
Mm.
But one of the things that worries me is that it is about giving up on paid work, and I think it's important that it isn't part of that. There's lots of things that we want to do. In fact, we're constantly told by our politicians that we can't afford certain things. So we can't afford to have more teachers, can't afford to build train lines. So we clearly could have a lot of full-time jobs if we decided to do those things. And it seems kind of bizarre in an economic sense to say, well, we produce so much stuff with so few people that we don't need any of these people to work. Well, at the same time, we just don't have enough people to be able to do all the jobs we need. And I think this is potentially a way of being able to make sure that money is recycling around our economy so that people do get better quality jobs as well as getting a basic income. I think they can go hand in glove.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know where all these new jobs are coming from, because everywhere we look, of course, jobs are disappearing, particularly jobs that don't require a lot of high-level training. You know, we've talked in this program about taxi drivers, for example, as a job. I don't know how long you give taxi drivers as an occupation, as an organised occupation. Probably not very long, given the growth in ride sharing and the attacks on the industry in other ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can think of all sorts of jobs. I mean, it's not just lower skilled jobs, even higher skilled jobs such as being a lawyer, for example. Lawyers will tell you these days that there are robots now that will do a lot of basic legal work automatically. Renewal of licenses, for example, renewal of leases, drawing up simple contracts, even arbitrating on simple contracts, and that in future that's the way things are going to be. In other words, for skilled and for semi-skilled and certainly for unskilled people, the amount of work available is going to be less.
Well, look, I think one of the things is the nature of work is changing quite radically.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got lots of new jobs. We've got lots of aged care workers, lots of nurses, lots of childcare workers.
That's true. Mm.
And so part of it is that there's been a gendered shift in work from jobs that we associate with men to jobs that we associate with women. And that has challenged our understanding of what paid work is, what good quality jobs are. And I think it requires us to make a shift in our thinking about what we value and how we value that through prices and markets. Because the sorts of jobs that we're creating are things that we supposedly value a lot as society, but we tend not to pay those people very much.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of recreating work, I think, is saying, well, we really do value these jobs.
Mm.
And we are going to create good quality, secure jobs in places like aged care that have good career structures and which are seen like the equivalent of going and working at Ford was in the 1960s. We want those to be the kinds of jobs of the future.
Mm. I mean, Megan makes a good point too on the text line. If you want to join this conversation, by the way, there are spots free on the board, 1-300-800-222, 1-300-800-222. Give us a call. There are some spots free. Megan says, Phil, could we please not imply that mothers who choose to stay at home to care for their children are not spoken of as if they're people who don't work just because they don't get paid for it? That's a good point too, though, in the context of what we're talking, isn't it?
Sure.
In a sense, the universal basic income says, yes, if you're doing that, we recognise that that is work. In fact, we recognise that you may be doing something useful for the community. It might even be caring. That it isn't in a formal structure such as you're saying.
And sorry, I didn't mean to imply that. I was partly pointing out that going to school and staying at home and caring for people are both things that we would think are valuable. And so we shouldn't worry about the fact that people aren't in paid work if they're the kinds of things that people do. And mm-hmm. the evidence is, if they're not in paid work, the sorts of things that people do are things that we would value in the community anyway.
Mm. Yeah, some people, I mean, David saying what a load of rubbish, scrapping the minimum wage will create jobs. Well, the trouble is, Dave, yeah, I know, David, that may well in theory be right, because after all, if you reduce the price of labour, you'll presumably increase the demand for it because it'll be cheaper. But you then get a situation which you've got in the United States, haven't you, where you've got a massive social breakdown with a society in which a lot of people work but can't live.
Oh, like they have a much worse problem than we do, partly because their medical system is so hopeless. And you know, generally speaking, their social security system.
Dave's given us a call. He can talk about it himself. Evening, David.
Evening, guys. I think that scrapping the minimum wage would be a great idea because it sort of creates jobs as well. And I know with my business, a lot of the unskilled labour we have to employ are lost guys that drift in and out of work and probably only work for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. Then once they're paid, they're disappeared. And locally in our small rural town, I could probably employ 4 or 5 blokes to do a job that I can't employ one person to do. It's too expensive to employ 2 people.
Hmm.
And it's very interesting. I mean, that's bringing up the supplier's problem here. The person who's going to actually do the employing, they have constraints. And so it's not just from the perspective of the consumer who, you know, needs to have a living wage. We're actually potentially destroying jobs if we set the minimum wage too high.
Mm.
And this is something that's been theorized in economics for a long time. There have been studies of this. There's a very famous paper using U.S. data, which actually doesn't find an employment effect. But we already, to a certain extent, do this in Australia because we do have exceptions for, you know, apprenticeship wages, for example, for very young people who are still in training. One could imagine extending that sort of provision for particular kinds of work that is, you know, seasonal or less skilled or whatnot. It is a reconceptualization of what it means to work and what the value of that kind of work actually is and whether we want those people employed, more of them.
To our two economists here as well, you could see a universal basic income working in concert with that, though. If you abolish the minimum wage and said, well, there is no minimum wage, everyone does get a universal basic income. If you want a better life than that, go and work.
I guess that's what these trials are going to try and find out. I just really feel that a lot of these people a lot of people's concern about this is be like, they don't want people bludging and sitting there their whole lives earning or contributing. That's the issue.
Yeah.
I know a few people we employ, they drift in and out of employment. They struggle to put through a long-term job and hold it down. And I just think a lower minimum wage where we could cycle through some workers and offer them a job, and they still make good money without being taxed, and it's something for them to do. I think that would just be very beneficial, and that's just from my perspective in a rural town.
Yeah,
I mean, I think
where the jobs are extremely limited in a population, a town of 2,000 people.
Whereabouts are you, Dave? Whereabouts are you?
Where I'm in Myling, near in Western Australia.
Yeah.
And
you know what it's like. There just aren't a lot of jobs around, are there?
No, that's right. And there's these people that want to live locally, live on the land and things, and stay in their towns. But there's no jobs here, and you can't blame them for not finding any work.
Yeah.
But the work that we'd like people to do isn't worth the minimum wage to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And often you need to employ a few people to do that job. But you can't have one.
Give us an example, Dave, of what you're talking about. What sort of work, and what do you think it's worth?
Manual labour, picking rocks in paddocks from cropping, hand weeding, nothing, sheep work.
Okay, hand weeding. What do you reckon it's worth to pay someone?
If it was to me, I'd need to employ for rock picking in a paddock, I'd need to employ 3 people to make it efficient. It needs to be efficient. That could cost me $60 to $100 an hour for 3 or 4 people, but if I paid somebody $5 an hour, I could afford that. And if they're not being taxed very much, I can give them a full day's work and have 4 people for $20 an hour. That's what I'd like.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Ben?
So I completely understand the dilemma that you're facing. One of the challenges, though, of course, is one of the reasons there's not that many jobs in many regional towns, not necessarily your one, but is because people don't have enough wages to be able to pay for things. So if you lower the wages, you actually then lower the amount of money that's circulating in that economy.
Yeah.
And you often get this, you know, negative cycle where you end up with even less jobs than you started.
That's right. It's a tight balance.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think one of the interesting things about the basic income idea is that it does inject a whole bunch of money, particularly into regional and rural Australia, into depressed areas in the cities as well, and potentially picks up that economic activity and provides jobs. It also then gives people choices about what they do, where they might choose to do things which are socially useful, including economically useful, but in ways that aren't necessarily in a wage-labour relationship and so don't necessarily have the same problems.
Yeah, good call, Dave.
Thanks for that.
Appreciate it. Thank you, yeah. Jesse's on, well, sorry, Mark's on the line. Hello, Mark.
Oh, good day.
Hi.
I think that a lot of our economic structures and endeavours, et cetera, have never really sort of looked at long-term sort of objectives, you know. Like, I think we're racing, heating up the world, it seems, you know, rushing towards making the latest thing that doesn't last very long, and we're going to have to produce the same amount of heat and smoke and everything like that. And most of the time, people, all they really need is food, clothing and shelter, but we could planned obsolescence, I think, is one of the things that's sort of really stopping the, you know, the production of something, a better society. I really think we're wasting so much money and effort buying the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, well...
Look, I can't disagree with that, but I mean, what's the problem is that you don't really have a policy lever to push to get rid of that sort of motive, right? And populations want growth. That's what they ask for their politicians to deliver to them, and that's what the politicians are held accountable to deliver. And, you know, growth at the moment, you know, can be done with making bigger and better, even if it falls apart the next year.
So. I think there is a possibility here. We used to take productivity as time rather than as growth. We substantially decreased the size of the working week over 200 years of industrialization. That process stopped about 15 to 20 years ago. Mm. And full-time workers, if anything, are working longer.
But I work longer as
so yeah. We have a real problem where we don't create enough full-time jobs. The people who are in full-time jobs are actually working longer than they did before. So it does seem like there is some scope here to reorganize work in a way that redistributes it more evenly to people.
Oh, okay. Give people jobs on different terms. Yeah, okay. 1-300-800-222 is the number. 1-300-800-222. Jesse's on the line. Hi, Jesse.
Hi there, Phil.
Hi,
Philip. I do a lot of volunteer work.
Yeah.
And I do a little bit of paid work, just enough to kind of, you know, keep the wolves from the door. And I work with wildlife rescue.
Yep.
And that's my great passion. It doesn't pay anything. But I actually think that the universal basic income is probably a good idea as long as people are prepared to do some kind of volunteer work in return. I don't think people should get it for nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, is there just stay on the line with me for a second, Jess, because I want to ask you another question. But just back to our two economists here, Gigi and Ben, is there any evidence that people will stop working if you take away the incentive, so the incentive to work? In other words, if you pay people a set amount of money, not enough to keep them alive, but enough to perhaps pay some bills, that people will work less as a result?
So my reading of the evidence on evaluating cash transfer programs generally is that there hasn't been a particularly negative or depressive influence on incentives to work, but most of those studies are done using countries from, you know, the developing world.
Okay.
So it's not, we don't really have a lot of information about the developed world, which is one of the reasons why there's piloting going on in Europe.
So we don't know.
Yeah, not really.
And
not
I think at the upper level you would, that is that people wouldn't work extra overtime if they were able to access the things that they needed a bit more easily, particularly housing.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at the labour force participation of fathers who've just had children, you find that they skyrocket because they need, you know, we don't have a very effective paid parental leave scheme. Mm-hmm. People have still got mortgages. We don't have a great childcare system. So that places a lot of pressure on people to work extra hours. If we were providing those things more effectively, we'd probably see fathers spending more time with their kids and less time at work.
I mean, Jesse, some people might, hearing it tonight, might say, well, look, I'm very happy for Jesse to do that because, I mean, I kind of think you might be improving my community in a sense if you're working on land care projects or whatever.
I do bush regeneration, I do wildlife rescue, and I do a lot of education work with wildlife as well.
See, some people hearing that might say, well, that's, you know, how is that not valuable for the community? Mm-hmm. And therefore, I'm quite happy to have that funded in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's actually, you say it's volunteer work as though it's somehow less in status. But do we need to rethink this?
I actually think that if we lost all our volunteers, the whole country would fall apart.
Yeah,
if
well,
you think
true.
About everything that volunteers do, not just me who does animal stuff, but all the human stuff as well, mm-hmm. the whole country would fall apart mm-hmm. if we lost our volunteers. And they all are very worthy causes that people are doing stuff out of the goodwill of, you know, out of their own love for community, really.
Mm. Oh, there's no question about that at all. So I had a book earlier this year about multitasking in the home, unpaid labor. And I mean, the quality of labor being done for no money is just astronomical. But this is the case in most countries, right?
It's always been the case.
Exactly. Because anything that's not monetized, though, is also not taxed. So in some sense, the country is subsidizing that kind of labor when it occurs in the home.
Mm. Pete from Dorigo says, don't we already do this? It's called the dole. Doesn't need a fancy name. Mm. Yeah, no, it's different, isn't it? Because the dole says, we will give you this money. We will give you this money if you while you're looking for a job, and we'll put some requirements that you continue to look for a job, otherwise we won't pay it to you. The universal basic income says we'll just give it to you anyway.
And I think there are two really important differences. So one is that the compliance cost with the dole has skyrocketed.
Yeah.
So the amount of money we spend monitoring people. But the other is that it takes a while to get onto it. So in a world of casual and contract labor, where you might have 2 weeks of work and then you've got a week without work, by the time you've actually signed up and got any support through Newstart, you've got back into work again. But that doesn't help you pay the bill and the rent the week that you don't have any work. And this, I suppose, one of the ideas of this is it creates a stable platform that allows people to be more entrepreneurial in the way that they engage in the labour market because they don't have to be worried about the fact that it's going to take them a month between when they lose their job and when they get their first Newstart check.
Mm. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Hey, Tom from Delaware is on the line. Hi, Tom. G'day, Tom.
Good evening to your guests.
Hey, how are you? Now, you wanted to talk about Alaska.
Yeah, I wanted to say the reason why folks in Alaska get $2,000 a month. The reason they get $2,000 a month is the same reason that people in Saudi Arabia get a whole bunch of money, oil.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
The state of Alaska has huge oil deposits, and the state owns them. So whatever's pumped out, they get their cut. The state of Alaska does, and they dispense it through the population.
Yeah. What do you think about that, Tom?
I think it's excellent, but you got to have something of value to give. The nation has to have that.
Mm.
You know, mm-hmm. you can't just go willy nilly dispensing a whole bucket load of money. You got to have something behind it. Mm-hmm. Like, you guys got iron ore and all this other stuff in the ground, but you don't own it. Mm-hmm. Gina Reinhardt does.
Absolutely right.
Hey, Tom, another thing. Hey, Tom, before you go, we've had a lot of people very concerned about you, mate, and particularly your health. Can you update us? Because a lot of people heard that you weren't well, and you've got a lot of love from this end of the country, Tom.
I appreciate all the love, and cheers to Tony and all the other truckies and Spuds and, you know, and Mike from Frankston, he's doing it rougher than me, but they found a mass in my kidney that's almost as big as my kidney, and they want to remove my kidney, but the other kidney's pretty crap, too, and, you know, it's just, I'm looking at it like no dialysis, and I'm not doing any of that noise.
Mm.
I don't want to be kept alive by machines.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in chronic pain every day since 1969 when I ran through a sliding glass door. Mm. And God has me here for a purpose, Phil, and you know what the purpose is? Peace and love.
I know, Tom. Well, look, Tom, all the best for you, mate. And just keep in touch. As I say, there's a lot.
I'll be calling. I'm calling you now.
Yeah, so good on you. Good on you.
Peace and love, my friend, and to your guests and to everybody in Australia and everybody for their good wishes. I thank you very much.
There's been an awful lot, Tom, headed your way. So if love can fix it, Tom, we've got it sorted.
Absolutely. I'm going to heaven, man. Peace and love, y'all.
See you, man. Well, Tom from Delaware, regular caller on the program, of course. And I know a number of you were quite upset about the news that Tom was not well. Anyway, we're in touch with him and we'll stay that way. All right, back to calls. We're talking about the universal basic income and whether or not it's a new way of thinking about social welfare because, look, you know, to both our economists in the studio here, Ben Spies-Butcher from from Macquarie University and Gigi Foster from New South Wales University. Both economists have had a look at this. The one big thing we constantly talk about is reform to welfare and tax, don't we? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the issue which governments, you know, seem unable to come to grips with, shy away from, think it's all too hard, etc. And these ideas are these the sorts of ideas that they ought to be considering, do you think?
Oh, certainly. I mean, one of the major functions of a government is to, you know, take money in and then provide public services, which includes insurance for various different bottleneck situations that people face. And that's typically the way that targeted transfer programs work in virtually every developed country that we have. Mm. And the targeting makes it an efficient use of funds, in a sense. You're not giving, you know, $20,000 checks to Gina Reinhardt, so, you know, or you or me or Ben. People who don't actually need the money don't get it. And so you're meeting people where they need it and when they need it, and then you get out of their face when they're back on their feet. So that's an appealing aspect. It feels more efficient, and of course these are huge amounts of money. So taxation is a very, very vexed issue, because of course, you know, there are so many complex rules in place, from the path dependent way we tax people and corporations, and the loopholes that have been generated in generations of tax law, and there are a lot of entrenched interests, and you know, it's very hard to get new legislation passed, because really to do anything you have to kind of overhaul the whole system.
All right. Linda, hello.
Oh, good evening.
Hi.
Hi. I only came into the conversation, I think, a little way on to what you're talking about, but I just had a comment. I truly believe that economists have got to sit down and come up with a new economic model, because the old model of continuous growth is just unsustainable. You know, we talk about increasing our population because we need more people to pay the taxes, but those people become 55, 65. They then need pensions. You can't keep doing this increase, because you're just perpetuating the problem. You know, you've also got less work for more people. I just think that economists have got to sit down and think about it.
Let's put it to them, because it's a question that comes up all the time. Do we have a sustainable way of allowing our current system of life and government to continue without the economy continuing to grow every year? Ben?
Look, some people think the basic income is part of that solution, that it's a way of weaning us off economic growth. For example, we think back to the call that we had talking about volunteering.
Mm-hmm.
And then we think about, you know, making all those widgets that people don't really need that break down.
Mm-hmm.
One of the important things about volunteering is that people think it's immediately socially useful. So a whole bunch of people do things they don't think are very useful as jobs that they get paid for, but very few people do things they don't think are useful volunteering. So one of the things that basic income possibly can do is allow people to make choices about what they do, do things which are socially useful, which make the world better, but which don't produce carbon, which don't produce economic growth, because they're mainly based on strengthening relationships. And so if a basic income makes it easier for people to make those decisions, then potentially it's one of the mechanisms we can have to ease our way out of a growth economy but still have a high well-being economy.
Gigi?
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with the idea that it would be nice to release people's creative impulses and allow them to feel the freedom to, use their time as they most feel that it's useful and valuable to them. I guess the problem is, as I said before, I don't see the Australian population or most other countries' populations either giving up on the pursuit of some type of growth. Now, whether we're going to stay with the GDP as a measure, I mean, there's a lot of controversy in the economics profession as well as the political science profession and other ones about whether GDP is the right measure. It's something we measure, but does it really capture what we think of as what an economy is after? Not necessarily. But there is a competition between states, between nations, for who is growing the most. And you see this every time a GDP figures
come out.
But
what's the alternative model, though? Because, after all, I mean, the economic growth is based on the pretty simple idea that every year there are more people coming into the market, mm-hmm. the population is growing, and that if we're to provide more jobs and more services for people, we have to grow the pie.
The problem is measurement, right? I mean, this is the reason why we're stuck with GDP, is because that's what's being measured, and that's what gets counted, and that's where all the yardsticking gets done internationally. If you really wanted to value something else, like, you know, the quality of time being spent every day by people, what is the quality of life? What is the quality of work, right? Then you need to measure it. Mm. We don't have measures of that.
Okay, all right. Ed's got a question about the minimum wage. Yes. Hello, Ed. G'day, Ed.
Ed, oh, yeah, sorry, that's me. Just a really two quick points. One is, would your presenters there consider perhaps talking a little bit about the effect of minimum wage on causing a sort of inflation in the value of the dollar? Therefore, if you artificially increase the minimum wage, especially when it's done for political reasons as opposed to a natural evolution of economics,
yeah.
Do you effectively cause a sort of inflation?
So does it increase inflation?
Yeah. Well, not real inflation, but an effective inflation. So it costs that much more to produce the loaf of bread because everyone has that much mm-hmm. more money,
yeah.
mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. The second point is, what about, I don't know, I came in halfway through this conversation, so I don't know if you've talked about employment during weekends and the out of hours. Why should that be paid at a higher rate? You know, surely there are people who would like to work those hours, but because it is a higher rate, perhaps those jobs aren't made available.
Okay. All right. Yep. All right. We've got those points here. Who wants to go here? Gigi?
Sure. So, I mean, the first point is certainly a very valid one. So if you essentially give a lot more money, a lot more purchasing power to the demand side of any market, then demand is going to shift out and you're going to have some of that then absorbed in a higher price for your products. Mm. And particularly if you're saying this is going to be a long-term policy, every single year we're going to give this amount of money to everyone. You know, there are reference-dependent preferences. In other words, people get used to things and the market will start to absorb that. And so you may find, in fact, that the prices of things like housing, if you don't provide that in a separate program, may start to creep up a bit because there's just more purchasing power out there. So that's definitely a concern. In relation to, you know, Sunday rates and whatnot, I think it's a massive, it's a holdover from, you know, many years ago when I think there was much more of a nanny state mentality about, you know, people shouldn't be forced to work or they shouldn't actually be working at all on Saturdays or on Sundays because it's kind of antisocial and, you know, not family oriented. And now we have a much more flexible kind of society with a lot more heterogeneity in beliefs and preferences about how one should spend their time. And so,
I mean, people defend penalty rates, though, on the basis that what they're really defending is income. I mean, they're saying, look, you know, this is my life, and my life is based on a certain level of income, and part of that income is comprised of penalty rates. And essentially, that's what people are defending, aren't they, rather than necessarily, I need to get paid more on Saturday or Sunday.
Well, I think there is a question here about whether we live in a society or an economy, and economics profession does naturally tend towards saying, well, you know, people should be allowed to make whatever choices they want. This is just the way things work. But people are working much longer hours. We should be thinking about how we deal with that. But we also, I think, should be saying, well, we do want everyone to get together at certain times to be able to form communities. And it is very difficult to form communities where there is no set aside time for everyone to be together and to do things collectively. It's also just not true that most people work these odd hours. Mm. The vast bulk of our workforce still works 9 to 5, mm-hmm. Monday to Friday. Mm. It is a social norm, mm-hmm. and it is partly reinforced by those penalty rates. And we would have a radically different society if we start to strip that back. And, you know, as with the growth argument, I'm not sure that that actually adds to well-being very much. So I think it's entirely reasonable to have those kinds of restrictions.
Mm. Okay. All right. Love your contributions. 1-300-800-222 is the number. If you'd like to call, you can call, text us 0467-922-702. We're talking about the idea of a universal basic income. Our two economists are Ben Spees-Butcher from Macquarie University and Gigi Foster from the University of New South Wales.
Across Australia, this is Nightlife with Philip Clark.
It's 13 to 11, 13 to 10 in Queensland, and 13 to 8 in Western Australia. Let's get back to calls. Martin, hi.
Hi there. I had just two points, but just listening to you, one point, I've forgotten one point that's arisen while I've been talking. As far as I'm concerned, you can get rid of penalty rights on the day the Parliament sits on a Sunday and grand finals are played on a Tuesday.
Yeah, very good.
Right. Now, my real 2 points, one about your main subject and one about tax and welfare.
Mm-hmm.
Universal basic income is fine, but that's just putting money in people's pockets. If you had a job guarantee system, you're giving people a purpose and a dignity of having a job and an income from what they've done. So they have a purpose and dignity, and the sort of jobs are not just moving rocks around. I'm part of quite a large group of people who think about these topics all the time, and communicate a lot on Facebook about them.
Mm.
Local government could employ large numbers of people in expanding social programs if the funding was available. They would be very worthwhile programs. They could take hundreds or thousands of people in every state. All that's lacking is the funding.
Yeah, all right. I guess that's right. I mean, anybody who wants to look around can look at the large number of public works that happened during the 30s, during the Great Depression.
And even during the 1950s and 60s, we effectively had a form of job guarantee where on many railway sites, for example, you could go down and pick up a job on the day. And that was essentially run by governments as a kind of way of ensuring full employment. And that was an explicit goal of government policy, was to make sure that everyone who wanted a job could have a job. Our government's changed their mind and we don't have that commitment anymore.
But I totally agree with the caller. I mean, I think this is an underutilized policy lever, and I think there's a couple of other advantages he didn't mention. One of them is that the government can build in skills training. They can build in apprenticeship type preparation and matching people with, expert tradesmen, for example, because we always have chronic shortages of tradesmen. I mean, we can fix that. We can put in this kind of program. And secondly, the government can decide if there is an undersupply of labor in particular areas. You know, Ben was earlier mentioning some of the caring professions. Aged care and child care, the government can say, you know what, fine, not enough labor. We're going to, have a short-term infusion of people into that profession, train them up, get them out there and fix the problem rather than, having some of the more costly other interventions. So I think it just is a great idea and it should be used more. And I think we should get rid of the phrase work for the dole, because that's a horrible name, and maybe, change that kind of program into something that looks a little more like
Because a lot of the discussion we're having tonight actually is about redefining what work is, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and getting away from the idea that some jobs have more importance than others simply because of what they are. Susan, it's probably a point you want to make too. Hi, Susan.
Oh, honestly, I don't even know where to start. I'm sorry. I actually had to promise your producer that I wouldn't get angry and get her into trouble.
Okay.
Because it's true. Now,
we don't want to get Suki into trouble, so away you go.
I'm listening to two people who've obviously not spent the last 30 years of their life working shift work, like hundreds of thousands of other nurses, policemen, ambulance officers, people who get paid penalty rates, and they get paid that for the dislocation to their life,
mm-hmm.
for never, ever getting to spend time with their families on weekends, for staying up all night and looking after these people's relatives when they're sick in hospital.
Yeah, you're a registered nurse, are you, Susan?
Yeah, and I'm a registered nurse, right?
Right.
And I cannot tell you the damage that 30 years of shift work has done, A, to my health, and B, to my actual life, to my social life, to my normal everyday spending time with, and the cost to my family, I might add, of me not being there, right?
Yeah, yeah. How would Susan? I get what you do, and I think everybody values what you do. I mean, the community values what you do. You might think they're not valuing enough in terms of money, and that's another issue. But can I ask you this question though? How would we do this better? If you're a registered nurse, you know what the skills are. They're high level skills. How would we do this kind of work better?
I don't understand the question really, because a lot of the problems that you're talking about are because people aren't employing registered nurses.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Didn't one of your guests say we should not work for the dole people to look after aged care and to look after people in the caring profession? It takes 4 years or 3 years to learn to do that. Do you really think that you can train up somebody off the dole in 6 weeks to provide the kind of care that people need. If you want people who've been trained for 6 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever you're talking about to be looking after your mother or your father or your child, what you're talking about just makes me so angry, and I'm sure that there are lots of other people out there who are just as angry. I just happen to be driving home from work at the moment.
I'm not sure.
I haven't had my dinner yet.
Can I get Gigi to address that point? Because I'm not sure that you were suggesting that we suddenly employ lots of registered nurses. Although the truth is there are lots of registered nurses who are not working.
Absolutely, which is another problem. But in terms of the way in which the government could potentially help people who are out of work, underemployed, and essentially in a bottleneck situation to try to reaccess labor markets, yes, I mean, it would be great to start them off. I have no, I've absolutely, you know, no beef with the comment that it would be impossible to train someone up to the level of a registered nurse in you know, even a year. But I think there are positions that can be filled. And I mean, my own mother had Alzheimer's for 5 years in Florida. I've seen multiple different kinds of jobs in the healthcare industry that are surrounding aged care. And I know that there is definitely a hierarchy of skills, and there is a need, even at the lower level of skill there. Well, I think we can target some kinds of jobs there.
Mm, we've seen that in the nursing home industry in Australia, I think.
Yep.
Darren, hello.
How are you, Philip?
Yeah, good, mate. Thank you.
Look, very interesting. We had this conversation at high school 35 years ago with a teacher that everyone thought was an odd bod.
Oh, yeah.
He told us about how we'd have, you know, phones that we could touch and wouldn't be connected to the wall. And...
that's
anyway,
right.
That's besides the point. What I've noticed here is already the debate seems to be down the lines of the haves and the have-nots. It's already going on in society. You know, Australia's richest woman thinks the minimum wage should go. And I see the verge of anarchy. Look, and I work in the transport industry, and whether drivers agree or not, I think within 15 years it'll be half the truck drivers what there is now.
There already are in a lot of fixed site lines. I mean, train drivers and truck drivers in the mining industry, we're already seeing the abolition of jobs there, aren't we? Mm-hmm.
But what the issue I see is, once we reduce the work base and the tax base so far, how are we going to pay for the services? The haves are not going to want to pay more tax. We've already got the haves wanting the have-nots to pick up rocks for, you know, basically $4 an hour, which is not even a subsistence wage. I don't see how the economics are going to work. I just see the verge of anarchy where people aren't going to be able to even eat.
This is a really key question too, isn't it, Ben?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of the debate about basic income, about jobs, is about inequality and the skyrocketing of inequality that's happened over the last 20 to 30 years. And it's not even at the broad middle that's got wealthier. It's not even the top 1%. It's really the top 0.1% or 0.01%.
Well, exactly.
It's extraordinary.
Yep. It's been argued in America that, you know, this hollowing out of the middle class, and we're seeing it in Australia as well. The extremes are not as great here, but they're happening.
And I think this is part of this is a political problem of how we increase the tax base, because that tax base is a lot of that question is about this very top of the income distribution. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we heard that Alaska has a tax... a revenue-raising scheme out of minerals. We almost got one. We didn't get one.
Exactly.
And so I think a UBI is partly about the politics of how do we create the political circumstances where we can increase the tax base in a way that will allow the economy to keep on functioning and our society to keep on functioning in those circumstances. And I think universality, saying that everyone's on the same side, we're all going to get something, we're in it together, is one of the most effective ways of being able to do that.
So we had this conversation before the program, and I mean, I guess I see it as a very expensive and an inefficient way to achieve that universality and to achieve, you know, some amount of this money going to everybody, including the worse off. But I completely agree. It's at the very, very top end. And I mean, I had a paper last year with Paul Friders about inequality in Australia, specifically what industries do people make the most money in, and it is the industries where there are a lot of government favors to be handed about. Property, mining, natural resources in general, investment management. It's not, you know, healthcare, IT, entertainment, places where you think, okay, a lot of innovation, a lot of technical stuff going on, you should get compensated. No, it's political favors going back and forth. And that is where the problem is. And if we are serious about providing services and being the government being accountable to the people, then the government is what we should put pressure on to rein in some of the worst excesses of that very, very, very top slice of the populace. And that also includes, of course, corporate taxes. I mean, the rich also, you know, have our large shares owners of you know, multinational corporations and companies which skirt tax law in various ways and don't actually pay their fair share. And so I think really that's where the main problem is here. The problem is not as much at the bottom as it is at the top.
Well, I hear to that. I think around the country, probably people would be saying, "Geez, yes, absolutely, that is true." We're not. This is not likely to happen in the next cycle of government or cycles of government, isn't it? But the circumstances which are causing the discussion to happen and the pressures, we've seen it. You know, when we observe societies like America,
look, we don't want Trump,
and if we don't want to get there, But we're going to have to do something, aren't we?
Yeah, I think we are seeing, you know, we don't see it all at once, but we do see incrementally those debates happening. So when we say we can't quite afford family payments, what that means is we're not going to tax those very large politically generated profits in order to make sure that families have enough money. So I think this is part of a debate that says, actually, no, we can afford these things. And that's one of the ways that we both solve the social consequences of inequality, but also the political favors that are being done that aren't generated.
Very much so. I mean, there are also completely radical solutions to you know, revisiting the taxation scheme entirely that that are made possible because of the more electronic society in which we live now. I mean, one of the possibilities that was floated to me recently by a friend is you could just randomly tax every single transaction at a certain rate, 0.05%. So do away with everything else, just tax every transaction. Now, it's a very radical thing, but if you talk about, you know, the way in which hackers have been able to make huge amounts of money by just going into stock exchanges for 24 hours and take out this kind of cash. I mean, the government could take a leaf out of their book.
Yeah, well, we're going to need some new thinking, I think, if we are to come to grips with these problems. As I say, but don't panic. This is to talk about the future. It's not going to happen. It's not happening tomorrow or next week. Thanks to our guests, Dr. Gigi Foster, Associate Professor at the University of New South Wales, and Dr. Ben Spees-Butcher from Macquarie University. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.